Welcome to the Flow Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 1:18 PM, that is Pacific Summer Time. Today is May 18th. Well, this week was really all about the bond markets because US 10-year Treasury spent the majority of their time above 3%, and the 30-year got up to 3.25%, but was not quite able to hold it. And in fact, in here on the close on Friday, what we actually see is a downside key reversal for the yield on the 30-year. A similar condition is evident on the 10-year. So what that tells us is that there is at least some support starting to come in as we look at this 3% handle, and some people will be thinking that this is not an inopportune time to be thinking about possibly opening a long position. When we look at the futures price, well, we can see that it has been trending downwards in a very persistent manner since September. And when we look at it on a weekly basis and with a moving average as a trend smoothing device, well, we can see that there is an oversold condition relative to the trend mean, and that there is the prospect of at least a reversionary rally. One of the important points about this long position, this record short position in the Treasury markets, is that everyone has jumped in on this trade. So it is susceptible to some pause and consolidation, and we may see at least a pause around this 3% level. Perhaps the more important point is that when we look at the very long-term chart, well, and this is Friday, and it's the big picture long-term video for the various different asset classes, it behooves us to look at the long-term. And yields have been coming down for an awfully long time, and there is evidence of base formation development, and we can see that quite clearly. There has been a loss of momentum in terms of the downtrend over the course of the last 7 years. And what is also notable, I think, is that the volatility is less now than it was, for example, between about 2003 and 2007, or indeed between about 1994 and 1999. And that's also characteristic of a base formation. It's not unusual to see a base have an amplitude of 100% from trough to peak, and that's exactly what we've had in the 10-year, that the lows were around 1.5% and we're currently around 3, so almost exactly 100% from trough to peak. There is also something that is worth highlighting, and one of the points that that a number of commentators have been making is that the risk parity trade is on borrowed time. That was one of the most popular hedge fund strategies, and I think it is probably incorrect to say was. It is probably better to say is one of the most popular hedge fund trading strategies. It's basically saying that you can net off your risk in the bond market against the equity market and vice versa, because they don't tend to move in the same direction. But what we have seen is, with yields rising and equities not performing, that the risk parity trade has not really been working out. And today was a relatively quiet day on stock markets when we look at these major indices. I think it is worth keeping an eye on the longer term chart, and particularly looking at the 10-year chart, because it isn't that far off 10 years when the market started rallying back in early 2009. And we have some evidence here of the first psychological perception stage, which is disbelief. Because if you had talked to anyone in 2009 and said that the market would be trading above 2,500 points within the decade, you would have been laughed out of the room, if not committed to a mental asylum. Well, that is characteristic of disbelief. Then we've had the realization that quantitative easing is wonderful at inflating asset prices, and that represented the acceptance phase. So the markets were going up for QE1, and when QE1 ended, we had the pullback in 2010. When QE2 ended, we had the pullback in 2011. Then we had QE3, and that persisted all the way through until 2015. And then we had a somewhat larger and lengthier and more volatile pullback. Then we came through to the presidential election. And we had the dawn of not monetary stimulus, but fiscal stimulus, and the market took off once more. Well, following the introduction of the tax cuts that had been promised, and there was a lot of good news had been priced in, we had this big pullback when the short volatility trade imploded in January. And now we are in another corrective phase. Well, we had the acceleration higher, and we have this pervading idea in the market that the only way to gain any kind of performance is to index. That is tantamount to an acceptance that this market is, I think, heavily dominated by people who want to buy and hold. That is what the ETF market is. Is that as long as you just buy and don't sell, you will profit from this market. And that has now had some questioning because of the uptick in volatility. But the most important thing about this range so far is that there is a progression of higher reaction lows, that the market is bouncing from the region of the trend mean, and as long as it is doing that, well, then we can continue to conclude that this is a corrective phase. There are two additional indices that I believe are worth monitoring in that regard. The first is the NASDAQ. It has represented continued relative strength. It still has the progression of higher reaction lows, and it has paused now three times in the region of 7,000. So is this corrective phase over for the NASDAQ? Well, I would hesitate to make that conclusion. I would just have, I think anyone looking at this chart would have to say not just yet. So we may be in for some additional pause of consolidation. But as long as it is bouncing from the region of the trend mean, then concluding that this is a more than a medium-term top would be a very, I think, would be a rash decision to make. Then we have the outperformance of the mid-cap sector, which really took off this week. The Russell 2000 has broken out to new all-time highs. And this is potentially important because one of the important characteristics of mid-caps is that it doesn't require quite as much money to move the needle in terms of their performance. So the fact that the mid-cap index is breaking on the upside can be viewed as rather positive, not least because it also had one of the smaller pullbacks. And what that also helps to, I think, highlight is that we have had a rotation. And now we're starting to see the mid-caps returning to outperformance. And what I find particularly positive is not so much that it's just the Russell doing it on its own, but also that we're seeing other mid-cap indices breaking on the upside. So the FTSE 250 in the UK is breaking on the upside. The MDAX in Germany is outperforming. It hasn't quite yet broken out, but it's had a comparatively mild pullback. And the second section index in Japan is also firming from the region of its trend mean. So we have evidence on a global basis of the mid-cap sectors returning to performance, and they're among the first of the global indices to be breaking on the upside. So that is now starting to give us some evidence that this corrective phase may be on the shorter end of that 6 to 18 month window. When you have the mid caps that have already broken out, well, it may take some time for the large caps, which certainly the large cap technology shares are going to represent a big weighting in all the main large cap indexes. So that is something that we're going to have to see whether these technology shares can break on the upside. What we are also seeing is that technology-related investment trusts are also breaking on the upside. So we have to at least measure the stock market performance against some of the more bearish prognostications that have been coming out over the course of the last 4 months. There were certainly some people saying that this is the big top. And there was, and certainly when we look at some of the most overextended trends, there was certainly the risk of a pullback and a consolidation. And we've certainly seen that there has been a substantial loss of momentum in shares like Boeing or indeed in Caterpillar. They had been the ones that had clearly accelerated into those peaks in January, and now they are in varying conditions of mean reversion. But they are firming within their respective ranges, and those were among the shares that were most overextended. Then when we look at companies like Netflix, that is trading on an eye-watering multiple, it's still pretty close to its high, and this continues to look like a consolidation, which is very gradually unwinding the very wide overbought condition relative to the trend mean. There is another point about Netflix, and it is something that Amazon also shares, and it is that they have adopted this subscription business model. And when we look at the performance of the kinds of companies that have adopted subscription models, well, then we are presented with a rather interesting set of conditions. So, if, for example, we simply look at the subscription business model and just maybe 15 odd shares that characterize the performance or the adoption of this model within primarily the technology sector, it has had a transformative effect on their relative performance. So, for example, Activision Blizzard has adopted a subscription business model. And if we go then and just view all charts from that section in the chart library, Adobe was the first company to adopt a subscription business model, and it benefits from the fact that if you want to own or if you want to sell anything online, then you need a good photo. And the way you get a good photo is with Photoshop, and Adobe owns Photoshop. They made the decision back in 2016 to change their business model from selling iterations of their software to selling subscriptions. The model ability of their cash flows improved overnight. The ability to raise prices became much easier, and then obviously they were giving people an easy way to pay for their services on an incremental basis rather than have to fork out big lumps of cash. And the share really hasn't looked back since. Then you have Google is obviously, if you are investing on a monthly basis in Google AdWords, it's almost a subscription business. Amazon has got their Prime. Apple has got their music, and they are increasingly moving towards various additional services on the subscription model. Autodesk has got its Maya software for animation. Blue Apron is one of the new batch of mail order companies that is struggling to get off the ground, but it is a subscription business model. Cisco Systems adopted a subscription last year, and the share has rallied pretty impressively since then. Dassault Systèmes, Electronic Arts, also in the computer games sector, and Microsoft is another example. Netflix is in there, so is Salesforce. Stitch Fix is a new company trying to create subscriptions in clothing, and probably not enough of back history to draw a weekly chart. Maybe I'll come back to that one later. Then, if we look at Take-Two, we're in the computer games, and so is Ubisoft. Computer games lend themselves to the microtransactions, so that the business model that has been evolving there, which has really gained credence with the release of Fortnite, is that you give the game away for free, and then you encourage people to spend money inside the game. And this is not a new business model, but the way that the gameplay has evolved is new, and that is translating into completely new revenue streams for the gaming sector. So, what is the benefit of the subscription business model? One of the important characteristics is that when we're looking at the bond markets, that the kinds of companies that have come under the most pressure are those that were bond proxies. When we look at the fact that an increasing number of indices are breaking on the upside, what are the sectors that have been the worst performers? It's been the bond proxies. The consumer staples sector was actually in negative territory again today. That's despite the fact that bond prices were starting to rally. This has been a really quite considerable loss of uptrend consistency. And there is a short-term oversold condition evident, but following any kind of reversionary rally that might occur, it definitely needs to push back above the trend mean in order to demonstrate that we're back in a demand-dominated environment. The challenge for these kinds of companies is that they need to maintain their margins, but they also need to start paying out bigger dividends. That the yield on this index is improving because by virtue of the fact that the share price is going down, but that if we look at the yield over the course of the last couple of decades, that the real big support comes in around 3.5%, and it is only about 3.1% right now. So the yield is not high enough. And these are mature businesses. What they look for in terms of their growth is, in order to generate additional capital, they need lots of additional new consumers. Well, we know that there are going to be lots of new consumers, but the consumer staples sector is becoming more competitive. So it isn't that there's going to be money lying around for them to pick up. They're going to have to work hard for it. And at the same time, they're going to have to maintain their margins and increase their dividends if the shares are going to continue to perform. So it's not an unchallenging environment. And if bond yields do, in fact, continue to move higher, then there'll be more competition for them from that particular sector. What are the kinds of companies that do well in a rising interest rates environment? Well, it's either going to be highly defensive or value sectors, those that are selling at valuations that are way below what might be considered fair value. So the pure value strategy would work well. Then you have high growth, and that is obviously predicated on growth being achieved. But then you have the kinds of companies that can grow their dividends much faster than the rate of inflation or interest rates. And that is where the subscription business model starts to come in. And it is contributing to their resilience. And this is a totally new phenomenon for the technology sector, because technology had previously been considered a highly cyclical sector because their cash flows were so lumpy. And now that is translating into a much more modelable set of cash flows. And that is translating into these beautiful, consistent uptrends. So when we start to think about what are the kinds of companies that will do well in an inflationary environment, then we have to consider that it would potentially also be the subscription business model is going to be a big part of that. Well, when we look at the action that we've seen in here this week with regard to the bond markets, it might be a little bit premature to say that we're going to see yields surging higher. And what I do suspect is that when we look at the total return on bonds, it has an evolving type 3 top formation characteristic. It is a little bit oversold in the short term, so we may get some consolidation, but we would need a substantial rally in order to question the downward bias. So there may be some respite in the bond markets over the course of the next few weeks. And potentially that bid that we're getting in the US Treasury markets is some money leaving the Eurozone. Italian 10-year bonds are at 2.22%. They've been up in a dynamic manner now for 4 days in a row. Well, we know why. And the reason is pretty simple, that you have a outright populist government has just been elected in Italy. And it will probably be the beginning of next week before the final T's are crossed and I's are dotted on their program for government. But what the three things that are standing out are very simple. They want to cut the tax rate to a flat tax and bring it down to something in the order of 15%. They want to massively increase the social spending, and they're talking about renegotiating the fiscal the EU's fiscal compact. Now, fiscal discipline has been written into the Italian constitution, so they are also talking about changing the Italian constitution. And these are not inconsiderable questions. Now, when we go back and think about what happened in Greece, or indeed in Cyprus, there is one big difference between Italy and Greece and Cyprus. Italy is a big country. It's a G7 country. It's got a big, diversified economy, and it's one of the founding members of the EU. It's a lot more difficult to push Italy around than it is a small country like Greece. And I think one of the important points is that the new populist government has been used to these very attractive yields on Italian debt. And if they're going to be brought to heel by the European Commission and the ECB, the one thing that the ECB can do is to stop buying their bonds. And that does look like what is going on right now. And what that suggests is that there is significant potential for additional upside on the Italian yield. That does not mean that Italy will eventually leave the euro. Neither does it mean that Italy is going to default. But rather, it looks to me to be rather likely that it is in the interests of the ECB and the European Commission for Italian yields to rise right now in order to put some manners on a populist administration that has just jumped up in Italy. Because the one lesson that has come through from the European negotiations with the UK over Brexit has been that there is an institutional desire among people in the EU that they do not want to set an example that could be exploited by other countries. But what we have seen, and this is not an isolated incident, this is a trend, that Modi was the first of the populist administrations to come through in a resounding fashion in Italy. Excuse me, in India. Then you had Duterte in the Philippines. Then you've had the Brexit vote in the UK. You've had Donald Trump elected in the USA. Then just this week, you had Mahathir in Malaysia, and the Five Star and Lega Nordea, or the League coalition in Italy. You had last year Action for Deutschland was able to garner enough support to get seats in the Bundestag. And that's before you even talk about the Freedom Party in the Netherlands and the fact that you have increasingly nationalist tendencies across much of Eastern Europe, or indeed that the Russia administration is openly populist. So you start to put all of this together, and this is not simply an insurgency. This is a global popular movement towards a, or at least it is a revolt against the status quo. That people have been laboring under this fiscal austerity for a decade. They have not seen any of the positive results from it. The positive results have been concentrated in the hands of the financial sector, with asset prices rallying significantly. Those that have assets have done very well. Those that do not have assets have not. And this is creating a revolt against the status quo. And it's directly inflationary. So when we think about what the potential is and where are I think the big opportunities, we've been talking about three big trends for much of the last decade, and those are the rise of the global consumer. We have an additional 2 billion people that are going to enter the global economy over the next 20 years, and that represents a significant increase in the number of new consumers. Then you have a revolution in energy. And we know that energy tends to it tends to move in these very long-term cycles. So when, for example, we look at the historic oil price that can go all the way back to the 1800s, then what we have is this very long-term chart where we see that there are big bull markets followed by lengthy periods of ranging. And we've had a big bull market between the early 2000s and about 2007, and now we are in an additional lengthy period of ranging, which can have an amplitude from trough to peak well in excess of 100, if not 200%. And prices are currently on the upswing. So that is something to bear in mind, that it is unlikely that oil prices are going to trend on a secular basis for at least another 10 years. That the most likely scenario is that they're going to range in a very volatile manner, and that once this advance that we've had over the course of the last year has run its course, then the most likely scenario is that it is going to come right back down and test the lower side of the range. When we think about the Jevons paradox, that this contributes to the cyclicality that we get in the energy markets, that when prices are very high, it encourages economization and it encourages additional new sources of supply into the market. A big secular bull market, it transforms the fundamentals of the sector. And that is perhaps the most important characteristic of very long-term cycles. Long-term trends change the fundamentals. And in the energy markets, the big bull market in the 1970s, well, that contributed to the creation of the North Sea oil fields. It introduced lots of additional new supply. The big bull market that we had in the early 2000s encouraged the technological innovation necessary to exploit shale oil and shale gas. And what it has also contributed to is the realization that something needs to be done in terms of renewables. So we have had massive investment in wind and solar. Then we are also at a point where there is massive investment going into fusion technology. Fusion is a funny way of thinking about markets, because for the longest time it was 30 years away, and now what we're seeing is people saying 5 years ago they were saying it's 10 years away, and last year they were saying that it's 7 years away. What we've seen is that there has been massive improvement in technological innovation, and that all of the different enhancements that we've had, whether they are in deep learning or artificial intelligence, whether it is in modeling or supercapacitors, whether it is in the containment fields or the nature or the understanding of plasma, these are all contributing to to much stronger magnetic fields. And with much stronger magnetic fields, you can have smaller reactors. If you can have smaller reactors, then they're much cheaper to build. It's going to cost approximately $40 billion to build the ITER project in the south of France. But MIT announced 2 months ago that they can build a prototype for a tokamak for about $300 to $400 million. So when you start to think about the innovation that you're getting in those scales, the amount of money to be wrong is falling considerably faster, and that is going to accelerate the pace of innovation. These are the kinds of innovations you get when you've had a high price environment. People really start to think about economizing, and then you get these exponential leaps in terms of the the productive capacity and the technological innovation. So that is likely to contribute to a ranging environment on oil for the foreseeable future, but that range is anywhere from $30 to $100, and we are currently about halfway through that advance. Well, in fact, I think we are more than halfway through it, because this week the price was up towards $80. Now, when we perhaps just simply zone in on the shorter term chart, we can see that there is a consistent advance, and that each of the ranges are less than $5. And particularly since the low in February, the reactions have been getting smaller. A pause in the $80 area is not at all beyond the bounds of possibility. In fact, it's probably to be expected if this is still a consistent environment. Really, a sustained move below 75 would be required to trigger a midpoint danger line stop. It would be required to signal that there's a larger reaction, and it would at least signal that the likelihood of a reversion back to the mean has increased. But in the absence of a move of lower of more than $5, we can continue to give the benefit of the doubt to the upside in the near term, with the full understanding that the higher prices go, the greater the incentive is to increase supply. There are interesting things happening in the refining sector because of environmental laws. And I think that this is an additional thing that we need to consider now that we didn't really need to consider a decade ago, that the role of regulation and the risk from politics is much greater now than it was a decade ago. That we used to be able to simply look at money flows and trends, and now you have to have a view on the way that the political environment is likely to evolve. There was a very interesting article I posted in Comment of the Day about 10 days ago. It was from Quartz, and they were talking about the kind of research that is being done now on very detailed statistical analysis of the role of globalization in the demise of manufacturing. That there has been this knee-jerk reaction that the rise of automation was the primary reason behind the demise of the manufacturing sector. But that is just not the case. That if we look at the kinds of countries that have engaged most actively with automation, well, they're among the manufacturing powerhouses. There was an article in the Wall Street Journal just this week talking about Bosch, where they had invested, I've actually still got the article open. Here's this article in the Wall Street Journal from Bosch. So they had been investing very heavily in robotics, and what it had resulted in was that they were looking for an additional, that their workforce has risen from 42 to 10,000, and they are looking for at least another 20,000 workers. Well, they're not doing that because robots have suddenly taken away people's jobs. The reason that they've been able to do that is because the robots are taking over the mundane tasks, and they are employing more people for higher level activities. And that is the nature of automation, that it is more as a tool rather than a displacing factor. So the range of subjects that a robot can perform is likely to improve, and that is going to require humans to be more active and to work much more in conjunction with robotics. But what we can also see is that where manufacturing has disappeared, and where sectors have literally been just eliminated from various economies, is as a result of globalization. And I think that the most likely scenario is when you start to marry these types of statistics up with this broad-based unhappiness with people's lot and the rise of what is variously described as populism or xenophobia or this revolt against the status quo, then what we are likely to have is a revolt against globalization. And the USA is at the forefront of that right now because it has been one of the slowest countries to adopt automation, and it has been more than happy to allow the denuding of its industrial heartland in order to boost economic growth abroad because during the Clinton administration, they made a big bet on global trade. They were hoping that there was this magic number in terms of GNP that when a country has historically got up towards the $5,500 per capita in terms of GNP, then liberalism and democracy tend to flourish. They were making a clear bet that that is what would happen in China. And that is not what happened in China. What that faulty analysis failed to really comprehend was that governance is everything. That you need to have improving standards of governance if you're going to have liberalism and democracy and respect for the rule of law flourish. In the absence of improving governance, you can have economic growth, but you needn't necessarily have a flowering of democracy. And I think now what is happening is that the USA in particular is starting to come to that realization because the three primary characteristics of improving governance from the perspective of markets, not any other particular factor, but from the perspective of shareholders and companies, it is that you have an independent judiciary, you have minority shareholder rights, so that when something goes wrong or the chairman tries to run away with your money, you have recourse to the courts, which are independent, and you need to have an independent media as well, so that when the people in power start to run away with themselves and get heady on their power, that they can be brought back down to earth by some of their misdeeds being aired in public. Well, China doesn't have any of those characteristics. But on top of that, it is in fact becoming more Orwellian, that they are actively, obviously there is no right to freedom of speech, and there is also an outright war going on in terms of freedom of association. So they are keeping an eye on people's social media. They are monitoring the social media postings, how people are gathering, where they're gathering, their electricity meters. They're introducing a social credit score, and all of that is aimed at the I think further curtailing the improving standards of governance. So that's an important characteristic. Because when you start to think about these facts, that you've had the rise of globalization, which has lifted hundreds of millions of people out of poverty, but it has not represented a flowering of democracy everywhere. There have been notable success stories and there have been notable failures, but it has had nothing to do with globalization itself, but rather the quality or the standards of governance within those respective countries. And that is now being, I think there is a greater acceptance of that fact. So when we think about it in those terms, then the real enemy in terms of individual productivity is not technology, but in terms of globalization. And that really does open up the potential for greater populism and even more a greater prospect of trade wars. Then you have, that's just one side of the equation. On the other side of the equation, you have countries that are rapidly progressing, that have this historical view that they want to regain their position of dominance that they had for hundreds of years and have lost over the last 100 years, so that they're on the way back and that they don't want anything to stop them. Well, this is there have been a number of instances over the centuries where you have had an established power being superseded by an ascendant power, and there are only a very small handful of cases where that did not result in war. So it is going to require a great deal of fancy footwork on behalf of diplomats to ensure that we do not end up in a multipolar world with countries making a decision whether they're going to be in the USA's sphere of influence or in China's. Because China is building a blue water navy. They just launched their first domestically built aircraft carrier. They have their first foreign base in Djibouti. They've been building military bases in the South China Sea. They are looking at securing their trade routes by the Belt and Road Initiative, by building infrastructure in Africa, and increasing the size of their military internationally. So they are looking at superpower status. They are also looking at increasing the tradability of the renminbi. And more than that, what they want to try and do is to reduce the dollarization of the international market. So the renminbi has strengthened up pretty considerably over the course of the last 18 months, but now the dollar is in the ascendancy once more. And the dollar has been trending lower for a considerable period of time, and now it is testing key areas of resistance. So against the Asia dollar index, which has a lot of renminbi in it, it is right in the region of the trend mean. When we look at the dollar index, which has a lot of euro and yen in it, then it is already above the trend mean and is improving upon that performance. And the Latin American dollar index, which has a lot of real and Mexican peso, is trading at new closing lows. So there is a substantial dollar rally going on, not least because of what's going on in Europe, and also because of what's going on in China. The A-share index has got 200 of its constituents will be entering the MSCI Emerging Markets Index on June 1st. It should be rallying, and it was in positive territory in here today. Generally speaking, when a market receives that kind of news, then you get a really impressive rally, but that has not yet really occurred. And part of the reason for that is because that China is no longer an autocratic state, but it's a dictatorship now. So you're getting an increasing amount of power concentrated in the hands of a single person. There was a lot of people were making very swift comparisons between the evolution of Trump and Plato's description of how a tyranny eventually develops. And what we're starting to see in China is something along those lines, because the change from an autocracy, they've skipped democracy and they've gone directly to tyranny. And I'm very much removed, or reminded of Napoleon's Après-moi le déluge. What is going to happen after Xi leaves power? There is going to be almost a civil war within the party in order to decide who is going to take over. And they're already stoking nationalist tensions. So China has got global ambitions, And the countries that are most interested in continuing to support globalization are those that have benefited most from it. So Europe has benefited most from it, particularly Germany. Germany held on to its manufacturing base because of its reunification with Eastern Europe, with Eastern Germany. That helped to keep down their wages, gave them a competitive advantage, and they have been able to benefit enormously from globalization. So Europe and Germany in particular have benefited enormously, whereas the manufacturing sectors of Spain and Italy, particularly in leather goods, have moved largely to China already. They're finding it much more difficult to compete. It is in the luxury goods sector that where we're seeing that they are really competing. And the luxury goods sector is rallying in a very persistent manner and continues to accelerate away from its most recent range. That's certainly a bet that people are starting to front load their purchases because they're worried about inflation. And certainly the luxury goods companies are doing rather well from the Chinese consumer. But they also have pricing power. And when we think about it in those terms, it is these kinds of companies that do benefit in an inflationary kind of environment. Now, we have to at least start to think about where is Europe going to play a role? Is it going to be within the Chinese sphere of influence where it relies on for most of its trade, or is it going to be in the American sphere of influence which it relies upon for its defense? And that is a rather difficult environment. What we can also see is that in on one regard there is a crisis of identity in terms of what the shape of various administrations is going to be. That people simply are asking questions like, "What about me?" And so far the answer has been, "Here, have some money." That answer is directly inflationary, but what people need is security in terms of their earning capacity. And so far, there isn't a good answer to what that is. And because we have these risks and we have geopolitical tensions arising, then gold is the kind of asset that should benefit in that kind of scenario. But it was pulling back rather sharply in here today. And well, sorry, in here this week, and it has pulled back below the $1,300 level. So far, over the last three sessions, it has not it has not followed through on that decline. But it really does need to rally in a dynamic manner to signal that demand is returning to dominance and that the progression of higher reaction lows that have been evident since the beginning of 2016 are going to remain intact. If gold can rally, well, then the prospect for a breakout and a return to medium-term demand dominance will certainly be bolstered. But so far, there isn't a great deal of evidence that suggests it is going to break on the upside. Then, when we look at the continuous commodity index, it is right in the region of the upper side of a two-year range. It was a little bit softer in here today, but really not in a dynamic manner. Over this week, and there is a somewhat overbought condition relative to the trend mean, but it does look like it is eventually going to break on the upside. Then, when we're looking at the bond market, it's the TIPS market is I think one of the most important to monitor because one of the most important factors with treasuries is that there's a lot of new supply that's expected and planned. But there's no new supply of TIPS, so that's not a factor in yields rising, and the yield got up as high this week as well up into the 90s and faded a little bit in towards the end of this week, and it is a little bit overbought relative to or oversold, I should say, relative to the trend mean. So we may get some pause and consolidation, but the most likely scenario when you have a lengthy range like this, almost 5 full years, that it will be resolved on the upside. When we think about what the challenges are, and this rise of populism, and the fact that we do have increasing evidence that the market is going to continue higher, I think it is rather interesting to say that stock markets may have entered a more corrective phase, but we are seeing an increasing number breaking on the upside, and that is positive. But we have these geopolitical tremors that are rising and that do have medium or longer term impacts. And this is an evolving trend, and the number of countries that have had a rise or a revolution against the status quo is increasing almost by the week. And this is all happening while we're still in an uptrend and we have not had a recession. These kinds of movements are going to become much more pressing when we do have a recession. So I think a lot of people were talking about how momentous the Trump administration gaining power in 2016 was. But that was still in the throes of what is almost a record-long expansion. It is the next big number of elections that we're likely to have in Europe and in the Americas that are likely to usher in even greater populist tendencies. So far, what we've had is a slew of right-wing oriented populists coming through, which have been much more about cutting taxes. But there is the prospect that during the next recession that we will have more left-wing populists coming through, and that would represent more regulation and the potential for the profits of companies to be targeted, for antitrust to become more of an issue, and also for much higher taxes. So there are obviously two ways that it can go, and I think that the most likely scenario is that some countries are going to end up with the left-wing way of boosting populism, and some are going to go the right-wing way. And I would certainly think that universal basic income falls into that left-wing way of thinking. And I think it is likely that we're going to have at least one country experiment with it. So, and one might argue that that is this basic income measure that Italy is trying to introduce now could potentially be part of that. Now, against all of that background, we still have this rapidly innovating pace of technological innovation. It's exponential growth. And we have these key enabling pieces of technology that are contributing to growth in a whole slew of additional sectors. And it is in technology that we have the answer to a substantial number of the problems that we have. Well, we've already looked at energy and the range of potential solutions that are coming through in the energy sector. And the global economy spends in the order of about $5 trillion a year on energy. But the global economy spends over $1 trillion a year on cancer. And the innovation that is happening in the cancer sector is truly moving towards cure. Cure is not great business for the pharmaceutical sector. Chronic conditions are great business for the pharmaceutical sector, where they can sell you drugs every year, whereas cures mean that they only get to cure you once. But with the evolution of immuno-oncology, immunotherapy, gene editing, gene sequencing, synthetic biology, artificial intelligence, and deep learning, these are all rapidly enhancing the ability of us to test new theories, to really come up with new innovative ideas. So these are very important themes. These are likely to continue to boost the global economy well into the future, What I think is most important is that the timetable on which technology iterates has nothing to do with the business cycle. Whereas the stock market is much more about pricing in future cash flows. So when we think about it in those terms, and we know that it is by embracing technology and by boosting automation that we can preserve jobs and create new jobs rather than them displacing workers, well, then it is largely that technology is the answer to a lot of the questions that are outstanding, most particularly about debt and how that debt is going to be paid back. And when we think about what technology can deliver, and particularly if we move into an inflationary environment, it is the deflationary impact of technological innovation that could help to keep a lid on some of the more inflationary pressures, most particularly because the kinds of innovation that are coming through now have got direct implications in terms of productivity. That I think it is very short-sighted to think of the innovations that we've had in the last decade, most particularly with regard to social media, as being the only example of technological innovation that has had any real influence in the last number of years. Anyone who needs any example should be simply looking at the healthcare sector, or indeed at the energy sector. The evolution of unconventional oil and gas is a very considerable productivity enhancer. So I do think that we are still in a secular bull market, and that it is being pioneered by this exponential pace of technological innovation. It doesn't mean that there aren't challenges. There are challenges, and we are moving increasingly towards a multipolar world, and that is largely inflationary. And the only way that we're going to likely deal with that is by embracing technology rather than questioning it. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.